This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
A bill on Capitol Hill becomes law.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media in Los Angeles, hi, I'm Bill Radke.
And I'm Steve Chiatakis. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It is Wednesday, July 21st. New regulations hit the financial industry. Now, how are we going to fix the economy?
If you're looking to buy a piece of an oil company, we've got one in mind. And the Old Spice ad man. You watch his video, you envy his abs of steel, but will you buy his product?
We're talking about detergent here.
Yes, that's right. But first,
at a ceremony at the White House today, President Obama signed the financial reform bill into law.
The financial industry is central to our nation's ability to grow, to prosper, to compete, and to innovate. There are a lot of banks that understand and fulfill this vital role. And there are a whole lot of bankers out there who want to do right and do right by their customers. This reform will help foster innovation, not hamper.
The law assembles a powerful council of regulators to be on the lookout for risks across the financial system. It looks out for consumers as well. Morris Davis is former Fed economist. He's now economics professor at the University of Wisconsin. He's live with us from Madison. Good morning, Professor.
Good morning.
Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke is testifying before Congress. What will the new face of the Fed look like now that financial reform is about to be law? I mean, you know, is the Fed up to it?
Well, the Fed is going to be asked to monitor risk. And the bottom line is that the Fed simply is not up to the task. And I say this because there's three reasons. The most important reason is that we do not understand what risk is. And the reason I say this is we had arguably the two top economists in the country, Greenspan and Bernanke, say something like the subprime crisis is well contained just 2 years before the subprime crisis fell into the financial crisis. The other two reasons that are pretty compelling is that big regulated banks, they fail all the time in other countries. So Europe recently and Japan in the 90s. And finally, we don't have very good experience thinking about systemic risk and regulating financial firms. And our recent experience with Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac is just an example that proves this point. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were regulated. They wound up, in economics words, capturing their regulator, and ultimately they cost U.S. taxpayers $400 billion.
Why don't we know risk? Why are we having trouble with that word and what it means?
Well, who knew that a few subprime mortgages were going to spill over to credit default swaps and Lehman Brothers, which would spill over to AIG, which would then spill over to every financial firm in the country? I guess the idea is that what appear to be small bets across a wide variety of institutions and objects actually are one big concentrated bet. And so figuring out that link between sequences of small bets and one big bet, we just don't know how to do that.
All right. Well, we do thank you. Economics Professor Morris Davis joining us from the University of Wisconsin. Thank you, Professor.
Thanks very much, Steve.
And for more on Bernanke's testimony today, let's turn to our Wednesday regular, economist Richard DeCaeser of Woodley Park Research. Hi, Richard.
Good morning.
Congress members are asking the Fed chairman today where the economy is going and what he plans to do about it, but he has already sunk interest rates to the bottom of the sea. What else could he do?
Well, they've got some tools still left. Number one, they can try and talk down interest rates. For the past year and a half, they've been talking about keeping interest rates low for an extended period, and people conventionally interpret that to mean at least another 4 to 6 months. They could extend that by talking about keeping rates low, for example, until unemployment hits a certain level. And that would keep interest rates low or even lower than they are now, and that would help. The other thing they can do is something they've already done. The Fed bought about $1.8 trillion worth of debt between late 2008 and earlier this year. They wrapped that package up in March, but that also has the effect of lowering interest rates and putting a lot of cash into the economy. So they've got some new tools, and in most cases really just new twists on old tools still at their disposal.
But Richard, if our central bank starts taking financial meltdown type of actions again, couldn't that tell investors and businesses to stop investing or run for the hills?
Well, if you think the Fed's doing this out of desperation, they've got a gun to their head and they're forced basically to do something dire, that would be your conclusion. But another spin on this might be that the Fed is taking precautionary actions. Things aren't really that dire, but they're not taking any chances, and it's more of an insurance policy than something done out of extraordinary conditions.
Okay. Economist Richard DeKayser of Woodley Park Research. Thanks for that.
My pleasure.
Also today, Congress is paying attention to a quirk in the tax code. New York Yankees owner George Steinbrenner died last week. Now, if he had passed away last year or next year, his estate would have owed Uncle Sam about $500 million. But because he died in 2010, his heirs pay nothing. Marketplace's John Dimsdale says there's a group of deep-pocketed Americans who'd like to change that.
The group is led by former Goldman Sachs chairman Robert Rubin and Walt Disney heir Abigail Disney. They hope the time is right to establish a permanent estate tax. They support last year's rate of 45% on family estates over $7 million. Why would rich folks who will pay the estate tax support its extension? Syracuse University economics professor Len Berman says they do so out of a sense of fairness.
I know in Rubin's case, he's very concerned about the deficit. And even though it's a small source of revenue, every little bit helps.
But some Republicans say estate taxes hit small businesses and kill jobs. Senator Jim DeMint of South Carolina is proposing to do away with what he calls death taxes. Senate leaders are trying to attach an estate tax amendment to a small business tax bill that will be voted on this month. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Listening to the Midday Update for Wednesday, July 21st. I'm Steve Chiotakis. For the latest look at the markets, check out the numbers at our website, marketplace.org. We're going to get a take now on the global perspective, what's happening in business and economics around the world, and how it affects us here in the United States. The British oil giant BP is paying an enormous amount of money to clean up and compensate those affected by the disaster in the Gulf of Mexico. It's already spent $4 billion toward that end, not to mention the huge escrow account asked for by the White House. Now it's looking for ways to find money to pay those costs by selling some of its assets. The BBC's Rebecca Singer is with us live from London with the latest. Good morning, Rebecca.
Good morning.
So what has BP sold?
Well, they've agreed to sell a range of oil and gas fields in Texas, southwest New Mexico, western Canada, and even Egypt. Now, they're selling them to a company, a U.S. company called Apache, and they've been referred to as mature fields. Basically, BP reckons they're past their peak, but actually Apache is well known for buying up these types of fields and boosting their production.
And how valuable, Rebecca, were these fields, I mean, these assets to BP's future growth?
Well, by no means are these core assets, and they don't represent, their sale doesn't represent a major restructuring of the company in any way. And even $10 billion isn't a huge amount for BP. But Robert Talbot, who's the chief investment officer at Royal London Asset Management, now they're one of BP's major shareholders, he admitted that this was a forced sale to some extent, and because of the Gulf of Mexico spill, BP wouldn't have got the best price.
Their negotiating position was probably a lot less strong than it would have been 6 months ago. It wasn't a great hand to play, actually. But I think the price is reasonable, but it's not as good as you might have expected.
Now, some analysts have been surprised at how quickly they've done this sale, although they did announce it a couple of weeks ago. But they do still need government and regulatory approvals before they can be completed.
The BBC's Rebecca Singer reporting from London for Marketplace. Rebecca, thanks.
You're welcome.
President Obama signs the financial reform bill into law today. The law does not include any punishment for excessive banker pay. At the same time, a tax introduced in the UK last year to curb the size of bankers' bonuses is creating a windfall for the British government. And it turns out American banks are paying the bulk of it. Christopher Worth explains.
U.S. banks with operations in the U.K. have already forked out about $2 billion in taxes aimed at limiting excessive pay. That's more than half the government has raised so far and is weighing on banks' earnings. Goldman Sachs just announced it's paying $600 million to the British government. Justin Urquhart-Stewart is with Seven Investment Management.
The U.S. banks are actually the ones who are involved most in the investment banking side. There are relatively few in comparison of the British banks. So what you were seeing was the Americans looking at though they were being significantly disadvantaged, but it wasn't by way of nation, it was by way of the nature of their business.
The tax is meant to be a one-time event. But Urquhart-Stewart says that with tougher regulations being introduced in the U.S. with the reform of Wall Street, he expects the British government to consider making some form of the tax permanent. And for a British government starved of cash, having that extra money certainly wouldn't hurt. In London, I'm Christopher Worth for Marketplace.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Wednesday, July 21st. I'm Bill Radke. For the latest look at the markets, go to the numbers at marketplace.org. In Florida, agriculture authorities say they have found 57 Mediterranean fruit flies. The invasive species threatens that state's $100 billion a year agriculture industry. From WLRN in Miami, Kenny Malone has more.
Medflies reproduce dangerously fast. They can fly unnervingly long distances, and worst of all, they don't seem to care what type of produce they ruin. There are over 250 different vegetables, fruits, and nuts that medflies can lay their eggs into and infest with maggots. A watermelon is not one of them.
That's a good sounding watermelon, too.
Melons are one of the only open-air displays at Jesse Goldfinger's formerly open-air market. Last month, a handful of medflies turned up in residential Palm Beach County. The Florida Department of Agriculture and the USDA swarmed in. They established an 80-square-mile quarantine zone. Charles Gonzalez is a regulator with the medfly response team.
It's imperative that we contain the fly within the quarantine boundaries.
For Jesse Goldfinger, that meant shelling out more than $1,000 to have his outdoor market screened in. This is the first medfly outbreak in Florida since 1998, when a few thousand flies near Tampa Bay resulted in a $32 million eradication process. Authorities say a swift response could cap this effort at $5 million. From Delray Beach, Florida, I'm Kenny Malone for Marketplace.
We got a report this week about spending on home entertainment. The LA Times says an industry trade group's numbers show sales of DVDs down. But the newer format Blu-ray is making some inroads. The release of the blockbuster hit Avatar certainly didn't hurt that cause. James Cameron's epic was the biggest Blu-ray launch ever. Avatar may be the new thing in movies, but as reporter Sarah McBride explains, when it comes to Blu-ray, what's old is new again.
That's the sound of King Kong fighting a monster lizard, then chasing Fay Wray in the 1933 classic. It's also the sound of Warner Brothers getting another crack at its vintage titles. The studio remastered Kong, threw in some extras, and is re-releasing it in September on Blu-ray. Ben Herndon's a producer at the cable channel Reels.
The thing about a restored DVD is it's the best it's ever going to look.
On a remastered version of The Wizard of Oz?
It's so good and it's so sharp, you can count the freckles on Judy Garland's nose.
At last count, just over 10% of households owned Blu-ray players. That's expected to jump to half of households in 3 years.
This little flurry that you're noticing is going to become a flood pretty quickly.
That's Tom Adams, an analyst at Adams Media Research. He says classic movies hit the sweet spot of the biggest Blu-ray buyers, men with good incomes and fancy TVs. I'm Sarah McBride for Marketplace.
We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Marketplace Midday Update. I'm Bill Radke. We're all paying attention to small financial matters these days. Los Angeles Times business columnist David Lazarus is here with a tip about tips. Good morning.
Good morning.
So, David, because of the recession, I assume restaurants are suggesting you leave a smaller gratuity than you used to?
Au contraire, you assume wrong, my friend.
Oh?
As a matter of fact, I was talking to a guy the other day who went into a restaurant here in Southern California who paid with his credit card, got the receipt, and like so many receipts these days, it included suggested gratuities on it of 15%, 18%, and 20%. Yeah. But he realized, wait a minute, these aren't the pre-tax amounts that I had calculated prior to getting the receipt. These were all after-tax amounts.
So what is the rule of thumb today?
Well, that's a good question, and that's something I was curious about myself. Emily Post, for example, says you tip on the pre-tax amount. And there was a conversation online at the Zagat site, for example, where they all agreed pre-tax is right unless you're just overjoyed with the service, and then you might do the after-tax amount. And yet, also, the participants in the Zagat survey observed that anytime you get suggested gratuities on your receipt, it is almost always the after-tax amount. So why is that?
Yeah, who writes those suggestions? The restaurants?
Well, is it the server? Is it the restaurant? Is it the credit card company? I talked to MasterCard. They said, oh, don't blame us. It's not us setting that. I called up the restaurant of the guy who I wrote about originally in this piece, and they said, are you kidding? We didn't know this. And in fact, the restaurant owner even told me, when I go to other restaurants, I always tip on the pre-tax amount. So who's to blame? Apparently, it's the processing companies. That's not Visa and MasterCard. Those are the guys who provide the machine that sits next to the cash register that is going to be processing the transaction. They have software that will include these suggested gratuities on it. Now, the real question now is, are they doing this by default, or are they doing this in cahoots with the establishment? I'm having a hard time nailing that down, but the bottom line is almost uniformly, when you get suggested gratuities on your receipt, it is for the after-tax amount.
Los Angeles Times business columnist David Lazarus, just accept my gratitude.
I always
be happy with that. And finally, Steve, you've seen the ad campaign for Old Spice body wash.
Oh yeah,
the tongue-in-cheek macho man addressing the ladies.
Hello, ladies. Look at your man. Now back to me. Sadly, he isn't me. But if he stopped using lady-scented body wash and switched to Old Spice, he could smell like he's me.
So that campaign is a giant hit, right?
Mm-hmm.
However, the World Advertising Research Center reports it's really not that effective. Sales of the Old Spice body wash have fallen 7%.
Hmm. All right. This is interesting because I've seen the ads, and they seem to assume the ladies, right? The ladies are doing the shopping.
Yes, exactly. And, you know, who would know better but the ladies themselves?
Right.
The woman-oriented website, Jezebel.com, pointed out, well, maybe ladies are letting men buy their own dang body wash. In Los Angeles, I'm Bill Radke.
And I'm Steve Chiotakis. You're listening to the Marketplace Midday Update.
American Public Media.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.